Hello and welcome to Ops and Hops, the podcast for those who like beer but have to work in tech to afford it. Today I've got Ruben DeVries, a platform engineer in the telecom industry. Ruben, welcome to the show.
Derek, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely, man. What did you bring to drink today?
Being from Canada, I brought Molo 5, which is the new infused cannabis dealcoholized beer. It tastes kind of like Bud. I'm not going to give it a raving review. Bud Light. Yeah, Bud Light. Yeah. It doesn't taste like Bud, which is probably a better thing. I don't know.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it's kind of low on the milligrams of THC. It's only got 5. But whereas like the average, like I've seen some other drinks and they have 10. So you're not going to get me really loopy or anything like that.
Oh, drats.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. Today I am also on the non-alcoholic train again. I am honestly, I want to get rid of these stupid beers. They are not that great. And did not have time to go to the store due to a blizzard, so I am re-drinking one of these non-alcoholic beers to get through damp January. But, you know, honestly, it's growing on me, I guess you could say. So
yeah, I bought 2, and I tried mine on Saturday, and this one is better today than it was on Saturday, so that's good.
Nice. A little extra fermentation time, I guess.
Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah. So anyway, Ruben, for some of the users who don't know, of course, you are another one of the members of the Discord channel for my courses. And we've been doing, especially over COVID, we did a lot of virtual happy hours that were just absolute blast, really got us through the cold and dark times of such a weird pandemic-y time. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of really great conversations. So, of course, I reached out, wanted you to be on the show because I'd like to continue some of those conversations. Yeah. So, Ruben, why don't you give us a little idea kind of how you got to where you are today and, you know, some of the big points, you know, maybe the big turning points that kind of influenced your ability to get into such a big field.
Yeah. So I think, like, trying to think of where the right place to begin. Like, I've been around computers my entire life. I've been listening to your podcast a lot. It's been great, by the way. Give it a props, and I gave it a positive review on Apple Podcasts, so that's good.
Hey, thanks.
Everyone else should do that.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, I think I've been computer. My dad started a software company. About 45 years ago. So I think it was slightly before I was born. And he ran that software company until about 2012, 2013. He sold it to a Fortune 300 company. So I've been around computers. Like, he's always been interested in computers. He wasn't really a programmer per se, but he always loved computers. And he thought it was the coolest thing. And so he always brought that stuff home into our home. And so we were always like, I had a Commodore 64 in like 1984. And like, I didn't know how to read, but I could type on the keyboard and figure out how to play Montezuma's Revenge. Don't ask me how I knew how to do that, but I did. So I've always been around computers. And I think when I was younger, I think you would probably call me smart enough to be dangerous. I remember not really understanding the difference between install and format as like an 8-year-old. And I formatted my friend in 1991 or 92. He had the Batman Returns game on 3.5-inch disc. And I formatted the disc because I thought it was install.
Oh, no. And,
yeah. So he had to go back to London Drugs, which is like a computer store kind of pharmacy / store in BC, in Vancouver. And he had to return it and like get a new one. And sorry, I think the statute of limitations is over on that, or I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, Yeah. So like, I've always just been around computers. When I was 18, I moved to Australia, and then I came back at 25 and didn't really know what to do with my life. And so I started working for my dad's company. And I did that for about 5 years, working in databases and getting that basic, like, that was my first language, was SQL. I don't know if, I guess we can call it a language. That was my first.
I'm pretty sure it's Turing complete. I'll have to remember, but I'm pretty sure it is Turing complete.
Yeah. So that was my first language. And then I started getting in from there. I went into dabbling with some Python and just kind of always really interested in code and interesting how computers work and how compilers work, and, you know, got interested in Linux and went from Linux to virtual machines and running multiple Linuxes on multiple virtual machines, and then getting into Docker and just started naturally progressing through the DevOps. I worked for my dad's company for about 5 years, and then I quit, and I kind of did a bunch of like system administration jobs, like networking, server management, that kind of stuff. Did that for about 3 years, and then I accepted a job at Best Buy Canada at their head office, which is in British Columbia. And so they have a head office in, I believe it's in Denver or Minnesota, I can't remember, but then they also have a head office in
Minnesota, I believe.
Yeah, Minnesota. And then they also have a head office in British Columbia for the Canadian website. And so for about 3.5 years, I worked there as a DevOps engineer. And that was really where I really cut my teeth into DevOps, just the DevOps principles. I know technically DevOps isn't really a role, but, you know, it's
we could argue best. That all day long. Yeah, yeah, I think I'd love to argue it, but who's got the time?
Yeah, exactly. No, yeah, it's. I think when people hear the word DevOps, they kind of get a good idea of what you were doing, which like, but I am firmly in the idea that DevOps is actually a set of practices and theories more than a job title, but whatever. Of course. Yeah. If you want to be pedantic about it. yeah. And then, so after that, I joined a startup and worked there for about 6 months, and during COVID, they let go of pretty much anyone that hadn't worked there for more than 2 years. So that was exciting. Just like, you know, start great company. I'm not going to mention them by name because they are a great company. They have a really cool idea. Yeah, I got let go after 6 months just purely due to COVID. Just shutting everything down.
Yeah, that sounds like a startup type situation. Actually shut down a company myself over COVID. Yeah. So I get it.
Yeah. Yeah. It sucks, but it was, you know, luckily I found another job. This job was CopperTree Analytics, and they're pretty cool. They were doing, and I think that's where I met you, was during that time when I was either at that one startup or I was at CopperTree Analytics. I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, it was definitely sometime between those two. I think I remember you getting a new role sometime while we were talking.
Yeah, and then a year later, I got another role, and that's the company I'm currently with, which is CGI. And CGI typically has no, it's an acronym, but it doesn't stand for anything, as far as I know.
I love that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are my favorite types of acronyms. Yeah. And then you've got YAML. YAML is another markup language.
Yeah, yet another markup language.
Yeah. Well, they've actually also come out with what's it called? A recursive you know, abbreviation or whatever. And it's like YAML is just another markup language. Seems like there's another language too that did that, but I can't remember.
Yeah. So and then from CGI, who I'm currently with, they have contracted me out to the telecom community that you described at the beginning. And I've been there for probably about 2.5 years now. And as a platform engineer, and it's been good.
Nice. No, that's,
so that's like that's the 40 really foot cool. view from my career.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that, what would you say, you know, based on where you are now, what would you say the most influential thing you learned, did, worked for, whatever, like most influential event over that journey?
I think for me, discovering that it's okay to not know everything, you know? I think at one point in my tech career, I wanted to know everything. And anyone that's starting out, I'm just going to give you some, like the 411, you're not going to know everything. You can't. It's between the speed that things are changing and the constant breadth of everything you need to know, you can't learn anything. I mentor a lot of junior DevOps. I mentor a lot of SREs. I mentor a lot of platform engineers, all these buzzword titles. I tell them, focus on something and get good at it. Right? And then when you feel like you've gotten good at that, maybe focus on something else. But don't try to learn everything. Like, I think it's really dangerous to try to learn everything, actually, because you're dealing with production systems, hopefully. And you don't want to make a change when you don't understand what your change is doing. And right. Yeah.
So you like the kind of the T-shape learning where you really dive into something. You got an idea up here of what you're doing, but you really want to dive into something.
Yeah. I find that people like, and you can have multiple T's, like I said, like, you know, like the way, like, I don't think it's bad to have more than one T. Like I do. In fact, here's the contradiction part. I would say it's probably better. It's better to be a jack of all trades and a master of none than have only one focus and that is it. And silo yourself only on that focus. That's probably actually the most dangerous thing in tech.
So get a few 80%ers, you know, don't go 100% in anything, but find a couple things and hit 20% on everything. Find a few others to get up to 80%. You'll basically be within a page of documentation away from solving any problem in those areas.
Yeah. Exactly. And that was actually, that's a good point. What you just said, don't be afraid to dive into documentation. And I will tell people today, like, everyone goes, "Oh, documentation's so bad." And I'm like, "Hey, bud, nothing as worse as the 80s. Like, like, you don't know bad documentation. We have all day long. Yeah. We have companies that are like, and I have legitimate gripes with Amazon and Azure documentation and GCP documentation and GitLab documentation and all those companies, but they are far better, far, far better than what I had coming up in the game.
Yeah, for sure. I would say GitLab's probably one of the hardest only because they have to deal with the self-hosted and the web version, and every time you search, you always end up in the wrong one. Yeah. There's always like a feature or something that's either paywalled or doesn't work in the self-hosted or whatever. And it's, I don't know. I run into a lot of problems. It's better, but definitely not as good.
Yeah. But it is a little bit frustrating trying to figure out which is the SaaS only product or which is the self-hosted only. Yeah. What's in an ultimate tier? What's in the premium tier? What's in the free tier? Right. I think I heard somewhere, and if anyone works for GitLab, they can correct me on this.
I know a few.
I know a few too, right? But I don't know if anyone's listening. So, I believe that if you have an open source product, then you get ultimate for free while it's open source. I'm pretty sure
I've seen that. That sounds really familiar. I don't know if it's ultimate, but I'm sure
might it's be premium.
Pretty close. Yeah.
Might be premium, but I do believe you get some sort of license on their SaaS product for free. So I've never tried it because I've always worked with the self-hosted, but
I'll have to dig through that and see. I've got a couple open source ideas I've been kind of bouncing around. Yeah, let's see. There is a program for it.
Yeah.
And GitLab Ultimate. You got it. Wow. including 50,000 compute minutes are free to qualifying open source projects. So yeah, so nobody really has an excuse.
I don't know what a qualifying open source project means. That's kind of a, unless they give you a definition of what it means.
Yeah. I imagine, right? There's a lot of stuff here. I'm definitely not going to read their entire page.
No. I'm not asking you to do that.
But I would imagine, they're looking for a README. They're looking for the, a good contributor guidelines. They're looking for, items like that that make it look like you're actually going to do something with it other than try to mine Bitcoins or develop security software.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it has to provide some sort of value, I would think.
Yeah. Can't just freemium it out and give one little section of goodness and then
here's my everything Python else is paywalled. Script. Hello world Python script.
Oh, of course. Yeah, no, that's
but I open sourced it, guys.
Useful. Do you ever find yourself having time to contribute to anything lately, or?
I wish. I wish I could. Like, honestly, the first problem is while I do understand some, I can read code really well, I'm a terrible programmer. Like, when it comes to, the algorithms and the data structures and the, I'm just awful. That part is just, a total different language. So I'm a bad programmer. I'm a good scripter. I'm a bad programmer. That's the way I see it.
You get shit done. You get shit done. That makes sense.
Yeah, I get it done. But if you're looking for a thing of beauty, don't look at my stuff.
Right. That's honestly mine too. My attention to detail when it comes to stuff like that, grammar, whatever, is just trash. But I know it needs to be solved.
Lack of comments,
notes. Yeah, I've got an idea of what would need to be done to make it work out. But, as far as making it work out with the fastest and cleanest stability, I'm not going to one-line it. I'm not going to do anything like that. But by God, it's going to work.
Yeah, it'll work. Yeah. Like right now, I'll tell you what I'm working on today, which is a pain in the butt, is that we are building these servers and I'm using Ansible. Because for some reason I was assigned I've inherited these servers from a long time ago. And so they're still using CentOS. I know June 2024 is around the corner, but we're trying to deprecate these servers, move them up to the cloud. We'll be using RHEL 9 because we are in a corporate environment. But at this moment they're using CentOS 7. And here's a little bit of, do you know what the last version of Python is on CentOS 7?
I made the switch to Ubuntu a while back, so no, I don't. I'm just going to guess because you said something. I'm going to say 3.4.
3.6. You're close.
No, I had to be kind of close. Yeah, what are 3. They on 3.11 now, maybe?
3.13 is in beta. 3.12, I think, got released in October. So yikes. I'm trying to use Ansible to compile 3.12 on this system because I need 3.12. The pip product that I need won't work on 3.6. Ugh. And so, oh man, if anyone here knows and they can reach out, Derek, give him my email address or something
of course.
Like that.
Yeah.
If anyone knows how to compile a product properly using Ansible, it's been driving me nuts. I would have thought that there would have been a module for this.
Yeah, I definitely have not tried that in Ansible. I still use Ansible for some, I've got some legacy stuff, of course, on-prem at a manufacturer. Mm-hmm. So I still use Ansible a good bit just to get some things done, restart some services, deploy a couple things. But usually it's just bootstrapping that machine to get it ready for containers and Kubernetes. That's typically what I use Ansible for.
So we're not using Kubernetes at this moment. We might move on to that, but being with a massive corporation, they're risk averse, and so that means they're usually 3-4 years behind a bit. Mm-hmm. The curve, just 2-3, maybe 2-3 is probably more accurate. So they are that we're stuck with virtual servers for the time being. And actually, so I guess I could say this. I support the platform I support is GitLab for this company. It's 18,000 developers, and so they all use one unified GitLab. And so we have about, I think it's like 35 staging servers and then 35 production servers. The only difference between the two are the specs. Like, so will we build out our staging environment to house like 1,000, or I think it's 3,000 users, and we use the production environment to house 25,000 users. So the CPU usage, the memory usage, that kind of stuff is where. But we actually got, last we checked, we got recommended by GitLab not to move to Kubernetes.
Yeah, they said, sounds right.
They were like, if you're using, so their recommendation was, if you're already on Kubernetes and you don't want to spin up some servers, understandably so, then it makes sense to use Kubernetes and GitLab. Like, carve out add some couple more servers to your cluster, carve out a namespace for GitLab and use it. But if you aren't doing that, then use servers. So
I mean, at 35 servers, that's not too bad. I mean, with Kubernetes, you're looking at, you know, an absolute hardcore minimum of three servers just to serve as the, the master nodes. So like, if you're doing three servers on each side, already you're an 11th, I guess, or whatever of, not an 11th, you know what I mean? One out of 11.
I think you need seven, right? You need seven pretty much to be.
I'm saying three is in like bare bones. Yeah. Nothing's going to work pretty much. Yeah. Five is pretty much where you're really starting to get something that's going to work, just because you can throw the load balancers and stuff in there. But yeah, seven plus is really where you want to be for something like that. So yeah, so at seven, you're at 20% of your existing workload. What the hell's the point of just adding all of that extra stuff?
And there were some stuff that they just said didn't do really well stateless. And so, I've read other blogs where people say, hey, it works fine, but Postgres was the big one that they were like, hey, we wouldn't recommend a Postgres server in a stateless form like that.
It works, but it's not great. Well, stateless is another thing. Stateful workloads now on Kubernetes are definitely now accepted.
Yeah.
They're not fun, but they are accepted. I've been managing Postgres on Kubernetes for a while, but it sucks. Honestly, I would much rather
just have Petroni just a couple servers and that's it.
Yep. Just be done with it. You know, hardware is just so,
or just use RDS if you can, or your Aurora cloud alternative.
I would much rather do that. I hate on-prem stuff now. I got the taste of cloud and I'm just,
No, I'm the same way. If you don't have to manage it and it's like RDS, yes, it's a little bit more expensive, but in the amount of time you're saving yourself and your company's saving, it makes no sense to use RDS, in my opinion. Like I crunched the numbers about 6 months ago when I was doing my solutions architect, challenging my solutions architect exam, and it makes no sense. It's like, you can save money, but you're not going to save that much.
Right. Right.
Though I did read that one blog a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if you read it. The guy that started Basecamp.
Yeah.
And he's moved completely out of the cloud.
There's a lot of conversation about that. I think we've actually talked about him on at least two or three episodes far. No, you're good. It's such a hot topic. And I think, he's got the money to pay the best of the best. We're not talking about, he's not hiring, he's not scaling up. He doesn't have his variable workload as, he's got it kind of figured out. And so I've still got to get back and listen to the talk with him and Kelsey Hightower. They both discussed it. on a Twitter or X space. So I'm going to try to check that out very soon so that next time I'll have that answer ready to go.
Yeah.
Send me the link because I'm interested I will. In that.
Yeah, I think it's probably really, really, really good. So, So what, how do you, do you have a tool that you recommend for load testing these servers and things like that? Do you have a team that's already kind of done that, or is there some, do you have like a way that you do that or recommend doing that?
So unfortunately, no, I wish we did. Like, I really wish we did. We just are using our own tools, like our own scripts. And I think GitLab does have a script that will do it, but I think it's optimized for their SaaS product. And so I'm hesitant to try it. We could one day, maybe. I could let you know how it goes. Sure. I could do it against my staging environment and we'll see what happens. But no, we do some thorough smoke tests and stuff like that. And the goal eventually is to get, is to build proper smoke tests to an integration tests and things like that and unit tests. We want to actually use GitLab to deploy GitLab. So we want to get to that point where, and we're not there yet. We're not mature enough yet. And I think a lot of that is because we're so risk averse, that, what we would like to do is we'd like to get like that when we upgrade GitLab, that it just kicks off a GitLab CI/CD pipeline and it uploads the change to our staging environment and it reboots all the servers and then, or well, restarts the services. Nah, wouldn't do a reboot on that.
It's not Windows.
And then, and then from there we would maybe get this if we put a load test against it and if it succeeds, then maybe we would schedule staging to do it at midnight or something like that with the CI/CD pipeline or something like that. And hopefully everything would work well.
So what's, how do you feel about, you know, going from a startup to such a, you know, different model?
Yeah, I
was going to say antiquated, but that's not really the right term. Yeah. Well, no. How do you feel going to between those two?
You know, I think that, I think there's strengths to both. And I would recommend to people coming up that try your hand at both, because you're going to learn things, with both. The first thing you're going to learn at a startup is the buck ends with you. You'll get a lot of freedom and you'll get a lot of power to implement change. But at the end of the day, if you break it, you fix it. And that's been my experience at least. And that can be really freeing, especially if you're a learner, a lifelong learner, which I also, you have to be a lifelong learner, right? To this stuff, right? You like, subscribe to Teachable, subscribe or to some accounts on Teachable, subscribe to Udemy, do what you need to do, dig through YouTube if that's your pain / pleasure. But you need to learn stuff. And so, you know, I think startups are a great place to learn stuff. And I think that's why one of the benefits that comes from startups is that these new tools, like, I don't think it's by fluke that, like, we were talking about Backstage, right? Backstage came from Spotify. And, but if I recall, I think Backstage came during Spotify startup phase. I don't think it's when they were this multi, I think they were only like this small streaming company in Europe, maybe Denmark and Sweden kind of thing in the Nordic countries. I think that's when they released Backstage. And it was because they gave their developers freedom to build something that made sense. And you might have to correct me on that. I don't know.
I couldn't tell you, actually. You know, Backstage and the whole platform engineering idea and all of that kind of came out of nowhere for me. And I've just always worked in companies that didn't need it, you know. So that's all something that I'm still getting my hands around. I really do want to deploy Backstage and get after it, but it's so much extra on my plate right now. I haven't had a chance.
So I know Spotify did release Backstage, and I think they did it around 2015.
Okay.
that's kind of my thought process. That's kind of my memory. I've got so much information in my head that sometimes I get dates confused, but
I don't think the date's really that important. I think out of everything, let's keep those databases up and not worry about when Backstage came out.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. But yeah, I do think it came out around that time. And I think there is a value to a startup where you will learn stuff. Right. I think the downside to a startup is that process has not been nailed down. And so when something gets set on fire and that person's left the company
or was laid off or whatever.
Yeah, where it was laid off or their equity kicked in and now they vested their options and now they're going to the next startup. I think that's the danger. It's can be really stress inducing. I think that a lot of startups have a hard time defining what this is my work time. This is my personal time. They will call you on your personal cell when they need you. Yeah, they don't care if it's on a Saturday. They don't care if you're taking your kid to the hockey game or the baseball game or if they're in a volleyball tournament or right. Like it's because they're in emergency mode. And so the process hasn't, at least in my experience, process mode hasn't always been developed. Whereas like with the more stable companies, process is almost too rigid, I would say. They have a formula and they know what that formula is. I see technology a little bit, and I'm an analogy guy. So I think of it a little bit like a recipe. You know, when you're cooking, you get to be a little bit more creative. When you're baking, you got to be exact. And I think that the corporate structure, the big Fortune 500, Fortune 100 companies, they stick with baking and startups stick with cooking.
I love that. That's awesome.
So I don't know. That's my view.
Yeah. Which one do you think you thrive the most in? And of course, ignoring the fact that you were laid off from that last startup, but you know, removing that, which environment do you think you thrive the most in?
I personally thrive where people give me enough rope that I can either build something really cool or hang myself. And and I am lucky to say that almost since I've gotten into DevOps, all of the companies, whether they're large enough or small startups, they've given me that.
That's good to hear. So you've managed to find some flexibility in working for the larger company. Were there any politics involved to get there? Did you have to how'd you earn that trust?
I think that I'm very open. So I like to talk about where I thrive and where I don't thrive. And I think one thing that's really nice, I think with startups, it's where I don't thrive. Well, you know, you gotta kind of, it's less process oriented. And so therefore you're okay. Whereas like corporate style, it's more, it's massive and they'll have someone that can fill in that gap where you don't thrive. So I've had some really great colleagues that have helped me. They've covered those gaps for me where I don't do well. And I just lean on them and I do what I do good and they do well. And then they do what they do well. And between teamwork, we make a great product.
That's awesome. What do you think is, you know, as a platform engineer, and I'm sure there's somebody out there freaking out, like, wait, a platform engineer doesn't use Kubernetes. It's not about the tools, guys, but you know, whatever. Yep. I digress. So as a platform engineer, what would you say, like, you are really graded on? Like what is a success metric for you?
Oh, reliability. I think. Yeah. Uptime and I think to a lesser degree, how much are, like, so for me, and let's just get out of this controversy, is what is platform engineering? And so for me, platform engineering is creating and supporting tools that help developers deploy quicker. Right. And I think that if you do that, then whether your title on your business card or your email header is platform engineer or not, you are probably a platform engineer. I didn't, for the longest time, I didn't really like the title, but I've come to embrace it a bit and just say, this is what I am. This is, I support a 18,000 developer GitLab. Those developers use GitLab to do almost everything in their job. Like, so if GitLab's down, they can't do their job. So for me, reliability, and that's the thing that I would ask, is how important are your metrics on reliability? Your SLO, your SLA, your, what's the last one? SLO, service level objective, service level agreement.
Those are the ones I usually use. I can't think of it, but
there's a third one.
So you're basically an SRE for internal systems.
Yeah.
In a way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the way I see it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. And I think another key part for me is, I want to be a developer advocate in the sense that I want, not only do I want to make developers' lives easier, I also want to encourage them or mentor them into doing the right approaches. You know, one of the conversations we've had, like, is like, I can't tell you how many people out of, and this is not on junior developers. This is on the computer science schools. I cannot tell you how many developers don't understand the basic fundamentals of Git, when they come out of college. Like, it blows my mind that they don't understand the difference between a merge and a rebase. I'm not going to get into that here, but we don't have enough time.
Right.
And I don't want to get on Linus Torvalds' death list.
I know GitHub just set up, just released some new certifications. So that's very interesting. I'm curious to see how those are. I've been seeing a few people kicking them out pretty quickly. So I don't know if they're particularly difficult, but I imagine they are very valuable.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And, there's a couple people that do a really great job on training for Git Basics. And I don't think it's a complicated topic. I think it's a topic that you could probably hammer out on two weekends and you would become probably better than 90% of your coworkers. That's what I did. So in that sense, I think you just take a course on Udemy or Teachable or take your platform. And I know, what's the company that does the visualization of Git, and they Kraken something, Git Kraken.
Yeah. Git Kraken.
Great. Kraken has one of them. Yeah. Has introductory course.
On, yeah, I know there's a Git. Really good Git visualizer plugin for VS Code that's really nice, but I unfortunately can't remember the stupid name of it. No. But yeah, there is a good one. So as someone who works on internal systems, do you ever find a lot of resistance to getting the resources you need because these systems aren't customer facing? They aren't revenue generating. I mean, I know they are, but also they're not, you know, you can't tie a dollar amount to these systems. Yeah.
So I have, in my current position, I don't. And that's because I have a manager that fights for us.
Okay. So someone does.
Someone does. I'm sure someone does. I don't get thrown into the fights. Probably because I'm not a great communicator and I might just get angry and say something and then burn a bunch of bridges.
You're but, doing fine so far. Yeah. Maybe it's just the, maybe it's the THC beer.
Yeah. Maybe it's the THC beer. But I do have a manager that goes to bat for me constantly. And I really appreciate it because if she didn't do that, I think I would have to do it. And I might not be working there anymore.
I mean, there's something to be said for that. I've definitely worked with managers that have gone to bat for me and navigated that political and corporate landscape, especially after you come out of a startup. It's like, you know, if you need something, you go straight to the CEO, you skip everything, you know, you go right to the top and you go to something like where you are, you've got to go through a lot of cogs, a lot of gears, wrap yourself a lot around a lot of chains to get up there. Mm-hmm. So I totally get that.
Yeah. So yeah, I think the key is find, if you're going to work for a corporate structure, make sure you align with the manager. Make sure the manager doesn't have to necessarily understand what you do, but they need to trust you. And as long as they trust you and they're willing to go to bat for you, you're going to find your life a lot easier.
Yeah, no, that's something I've absolutely experienced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, so we were going to talk about the project I'm taking on now. I don't know if you want to.
Yeah, let's dive in.
Yeah. So right now, what I'm actually doing, which is really interesting, is we are lifting. So the company that I'm contracted out to, they have their own data centers, like many big corporations. It's all wrapped in OpenStack. So you're using the OpenStack APIs to communicate. And so you can even use Terraform on them, right? It's actually kind of cool. Mm-hmm. The Terraform API OpenStack, the OpenStack Terraform module is pretty good. It's not awful. it's not as polished as, in my opinion, as the AWS or the GCP module. Yeah. I'd say it's about on par with the Azure module. I don't know why Azure's modules are so bad, but they are.
Well, they focused on Bicep and ARM a whole lot. I think they're starting to accept the fact that Terraform is the way to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Or OpenTofu, whatever you want.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so it's okay. It's reasonable. And so we were building all our stuff on OpenStack and just F5 load balancer, sending requests in and handing it off to our Rails servers, which then handed it off to its dependent servers. I think that's the right word, dependentive.
Dependent servers. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're shift lifting and shifting that to the cloud. There's some requests requirements, obviously, like any major company is security, like who has access to these servers. Part of the telecom is that industry is that we work in Canada, we work with the RCMP, who is a little bit like, it's like RCMP is a really interesting beast. It's kind of like, imagine if the FBI and your local police department married, and because they have a complete, they very much at one point, at one part of them do like the FBI kind of stuff, like so for organized crime and things like that. The Hells Angels, the Italian Mafia, we have the Italian Mafia in Montreal.
So are these the Mounties?
Yeah, they are the Mounties, but they don't dress like in red and stuff. And they work in Ottawa, and they kind of like how the FBI works from Virginia kind of thing.
Right, right.
Right. And then you have the police cruisers, like the 5-0, they drive around.
Yep.
And they give you speeding tickets, and you kind of don't like them. Yeah, those people, right? And so it's kind of interesting. So, but anyways, as a telecom industry, since that's our major policing, them in CSIS, which is kind of like our CIA, we have contracts with the federal government. And so we have to be really strict on who has access to the warrant systems that they use to tap cell phones, to tap home phones, to like people aren't allowed to see that code. I can't even see that code as an administrator. So how do we keep that secure? Right. Like if you're moving it, it's easy when you're in your data center. But when you're in the cloud, there's a lot of implicit trust that boundary, even though you're in a VPC and theoretically you should be closed off from everyone. Right. It's only theoretical. Like it's unlikely. It's highly unlikely. I don't want people to be paranoid, but it's not impossible, right? That's what I'm trying to get at. So we have a lot of stress with corporate security. So not only do you have to transfer the stuff, you actually have to make sure that all the teams are notified. Everything is very process oriented. And so we had like a staging environment last year, and we deployed it and it was successful, and we're all patting ourselves on the back, and we're like, 2 weeks, we'll go live, guys, we can push this stuff out to production. And that's not the teams using it. That's us pushing our stuff into production and getting ready for the teams to use it. And we got tapped on the shoulder by corporate security and goes, yeah, we're not ready to go. We're not ready for you to go. And so, you know, in a way, I think it's frustrating, but also in another way, it focused our team. It allowed our team to learn about the processes and the concerns that corporate security had. I think DevSecOps is probably one of the more interesting things to get into. And so you start to really dive into what they're interested in. And also, it just gave us some time to launch it right. I think that we were probably, with the agile process and the DevOps process of just pushing quick, it gave us a lot of breathing space to relook at our code, make sure it fit right, make sure it maybe it worked, but it wasn't, you know, perfect. And now we get that time to perfect it, which is kind of nice. Right. It's a pretty cool adventure, and I'm really enjoying it.
It's really cool. Security is such a big thing. DevSecOps is massive. I've been playing with a couple of Kubernetes scanning tools lately. You know, you got to dive through all the different types of control mm-hmm. and, you know, vulnerability libraries and all of that type of stuff, and navigating that, and just the number of things you see just on like the first scan, you're just like, oh, this thing's bulletproof. And you just run that one scan and you're like, shit, that was not bulletproof at all. Like, not even close. So, you know, you learn a lot. I would actually challenge people to go and get one of these vulnerability scanners. Just hop on, throw one of your manifests in, obviously without secrets, yep. and just take a look at how much stuff you're probably missing. And you might learn a lot. I mean, one simple Nginx script is, God, I think I had like 20 vulnerabilities on it.
Easily. Yeah. It's amazing when you push your code through secret detectors and through DAST and SAST and all those things, how much stuff will, and then add code quality to it.
Oh God, no, get that away from me. Yeah. That's another thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, Ruben, how should people get in touch with you? I think, you know, you've got a lot of really cool stuff to say, and I think a lot of people might have questions about platform engineering in general as mm-hmm. well, and possibly even about security, getting a job in Canada, that type of stuff.
Getting a job in Canada. So our tech industry is thriving. If you're a tech professional and you can get hired on into a company in Canada, you can look at legally getting into Canada. One thing you should be aware, if money is your biggest thing, which it's a legitimate motivator, Canada does pay slightly less than the United States. In my experience, we pay more than Europe and less than the United States.
That sounds right. Yeah, depending on this upcoming election, I'm not going to say anything else about it. But depending on it, I imagine a lot of people might be looking for jobs in Canada. So,
So like you're taxed more, which I don't mind. I don't mind paying more taxes. I've had job offers in the States and I've said no. So,
right.
So I just said no. Just say no, kids.
How would people want to get in touch with you? You best, you know, LinkedIn, Discord,
Twitter, those are, I'm not really using Twitter lately. I've just gotten bored with it. I'm not blaming Elon. I'm just saying I'm bored with it.
I totally get that.
Yeah. Maybe I am blaming him a bit, but maybe a little bit, but, but yeah, I'm on Discord. I'm on LinkedIn. That's probably the best ways from a tech point of view to get a hold of me.
Yeah. Awesome.
On GitHub, GitLab. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's great. I'll be getting this episode out ASAP. Cause I mean, we've talked about GitLab, platform engineering. We've discussed, you know, getting into tech. We've discussed all sorts of really good stuff. A lot of good tips on navigating startups versus larger companies. We've talked about security, government, Canada, everything. So really good conversation there. Really enjoyed it. So
yeah. Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you want to give the crowd one more cheers, just to say
cheers, thank guys.
You. Cheers.